Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's November the 14th. We are in Parashas Devarim. We are on page 950. And we're at the Pasuk Chaf Dalet, verse 24. Last time we described how the Jews could not attack Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And now we move on to the areas that they can attack. As we know back from Parshas Chukas, that they are going to conquer, or they conquered Sihon and Og. And here we're going to get a recap of that conquest of Sihon and Og, which are the lands in Aver HaYarden, the other side of the Jordan River. So on page 950, Pasuk Chaf Dalet, verse 24, Hashem says, Kumu se'u v'ivru es nachal Arnon, get up and travel and cross the river of Arnon. Re'in asati v'yadcha es Sihon melech cheshbon ho'emori, v'es artso. See, I've put in your hand Sihon, the king of Cheshbon, the Emori, and his land. Hachel Rush. You should go and conquer. His garbo milchama, and you should provoke war with him. You should have a war with Sihon. Hayom hazet, today, achel teis pachtecha v'yiraska pnei ash ha'amim, I will begin to put your fear on the face of all the nations. There's two words for fear, pachad and yira. Which
dread and fear,
yeah, okay. So, of all the nations, tachas kol hashamayim, under all of the sky, asher yishmu'un shimacha, they will hear about you, v'ragzu v'chalu mipanecha, they will tremble before you. How will they all hear about it? How will everybody know about this war that's about to happen with Sihon? So Chazal tell us that Hashem made the sun stop during the war with Sihon for Moshe Rabbeinu, the same way he would later do it for Yehoshua in the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, since the sun would stop, it would be known by everybody that it happened. This is not as well known as the incident with Yehoshua, because the incident with Yehoshua is explicit in the Psukim in Yehoshua. Here it is only hinted to because it says Tachas Kol HaShamayim, under all of the sky, all the heavens, and that's how we link it to the stopping of the sun. Pasuk Chavav, verse 26. So Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu to start a war. Yet Va'eshlach Malachim Mimidbar Kedemos, I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemos, El Sihon Melech Cheshbon, to Sihon, the king of Cheshbon, Divrei Shalom, words of peace, Lamar saying, Ebera ve'artzecha, allow me to pass through your land, Baderech, Baderech, Eilecha, will go on the specific path, Lo asur yominu small, I will not turn right or left. Ochel ba'kesef tashbireni va'achalti, food for money you can sell to me and I will eat it. U'mayim ba'kesef titenli v'shasisi, and water you can give me for money, and I will drink it. Rak eberav ragloi, all I want to do is pass through on my feet. Kasher asuli b'nei Esav hayoshvim b'Seir, just as the children of Esav did for me, that they dwell in Seir. As Rashi explains, it's not that the people of Seir allowed them to pass through. They did not. But they did sell them food and water. And similarly, v'hamoavim hayoshvim ba'ar, and the Moavim who dwell in Ar, they also sold us food and water. So we just want to pass through, ana she'avar es hayarden, until we cross the Jordan River, el ha'aretz asher Hashem Elokeinu nosein lanu, to the land that Hashem our God is giving to us. So Moshe Rabbeinu, despite the fact that he knew that Hashem wanted there to be a war with Sihon, and therefore he knew that there was no way that Sihon would agree to let them go through, because Hashem didn't want that to happen. Hashem wanted the Jewish people to conquer Sihon and Og. Nevertheless, he still sent words of shalom to Sichon. V'lo'ava Sichon melech cheshbon ha'avirenu, bo Sichon did not allow us to pass through. Why not? Why didn't Sichon allow us to pass through? It wouldn't have been a big deal. Just let us go. It wouldn't have been an issue. Ki hiksha Hashem elokecha esrucho, for Hashem had hardened his spirit. V'imeitz es lebavo, and hardened his heart. L'man titov yadcha kayom hazeh, to put him in your hands like today. Here we have another example of Hashem hardening somebody's heart. The famous example, of course, is Paro. But Hashem did it to Sichon as well, so that he would not allow the Jews to go through, that he would attack the Jewish people, and that way we would conquer him and take his land. When Moshe Rabbeinu sends for shalom to Sichon, knowing that it would fail, it says in Pasuk Chavav 26 that we just read, it says that he sent Mimidbar Kedemos, from the wilderness of Kedemos. Now Kedemos comes from the word Kedem, which means early or before, something that came from a long time ago. Midbar is, of course, the wilderness. So Chazal have two explanations over here of what that means, the wilderness of Kedemos. Either it means the wilderness of the Torah. The Torah is Kodem, the world, that came before the world. Or the Midbar of Kedemos of Hashem, who of course precedes the world. So what does that mean, the Midbar of the Torah or the Midbar of Hashem? So Chazal understand that Moshe Rabbeinu is hinting over here to the reason why he sent shalom to Sichon. Hashem said provoke a war. If Hashem says provoke a war, it means there's going to be a war. Then why did Moshe Rabbeinu attempt to go through peacefully? First of all, it's not what Hashem told him to do. And second of all, it's not going to work. Hashem said there's going to be a war. So why attempt to go peacefully? So Moshe Rabbeinu is explaining, I learned this from you, Hashem. I learned that I should attempt shalom, knowing that it would fail. I learned that from you. Because on two occasions, we know that Hashem did this. One is at the time that Hashem is giving us the Torah, Hashem first sent or asked the other nations if they wanted the Torah. Hashem knew full well they would refuse. Nevertheless, he offered it to them as a show of peace, that it shouldn't be that they're excluded. They chose to exclude themselves. But Hashem did not exclude them. He gave them a chance, even though he knew that they would refuse. That would be Midbar Kedemos, from the wilderness of that which came before the world, but that would be the Torah. The wilderness from where the Torah was given, Hashem still approached the other nations despite the fact that he knew they would refuse. Or maybe Hashem also displayed this with Paro. When Hashem sent Moshe Rabbeinu to Paro to let the Jewish people go, Hashem knew that the Paro would not let them go. Even if he wanted to let them go, he wasn't going to allow Paro to let them go. He hardened his heart. So he knew that he wasn't going to let them go. And he could have just destroyed the Egyptians, but instead he sent Moshe Rabbeinu beforehand. Before sending the plagues, he sent Moshe Rabbeinu to ask peacefully, let the Jewish people go, knowing that Paro would say no. But nevertheless, he opened with shalom. The Torah is telling us that even when you know it will not work, it is still appropriate to open with shalom. Knowing that you're going to have to eventually fight, one should still open with shalom. And a lot of times, I think that we don't do this. A lot of times we say that it's pointless. Why should we bother trying for shalom when it's clear and obvious that that's not going to work? The person we're dealing with is not interested in shalom. The people we're dealing with are not interested in shalom. All they want to do is have a fight. Still, the Torah is saying to open with shalom. So why would that be? Why open with shalom if you know it's not going to work? Now, you could argue, well, you don't really know, you think. But sometimes maybe it'll work. But the examples we're giving over here are cases where Hashem knew full well that the Shalom would not work. Moshe Rabbeinu knew full well that Shalom would not work. And yet, still, the Torah is saying, always open with Shalom. So one should therefore ask the question, why open with Shalom, knowing that it is not going to work, knowing it's going to fail? Now, first of all, there is always an advantage to open with Shalom because you shift the burden of who is instigating this to the other side. Now, if you don't start with Shalom, you can always be accused of being the instigator. If you start with Shalom, you can never be accused of being the instigator. If the other person refuses the Shalom, they're clearly the instigator. So that's a strategy. That's not a lesson. That's a strategy. Meaning you always want to have the moral high ground. So if I know they're going to fight no matter what, but if I open up with a first volley, then I started the fight. But if I open up with Shalom and allow them to throw the first punch, then I didn't start the fight. Okay. That's certainly an important strategy, but it's nevertheless a strategy. That's not a lesson. That's a way to maintain the moral high ground. It seems though that the Torah is saying more than that. That it's not simply that you should have the moral high ground by opening with Shalom. It's that it is always appropriate to open with Shalom, even when you know it's going to fail. That doesn't change the propriety of opening with Shalom. That Hashem always wants Shalom. And therefore, even when Shalom is not an option, and sometimes it isn't, sometimes there has to be a war. Shlomo HaMelech says in Koheles, Eis milchama ve'eis shalom. There's a time for war and a time for peace. There is a time for war. Even though it's not a good thing, but there is a time for war. Sometimes. However, definitely the preferred state of being is shalom. And therefore, opening with shalom is a way of projecting to everyone. That means to the other side and to yourself and to your side, that ultimately the goal is shalom. Even if war is inevitable in this case, but the goal is shalom. The goal is not war. The goal is not strife. The goal is always shalom. And so even when war is inevitable, when conflict is inevitable, the first attempt has to be for shalom, in order to establish that that's the main thing. Now that's not a strategy. That's a posture. That's a lesson. That's an attitude that we have to have. It changes the way you fight when you know the goal is shalom. When a person is focused on the fight, then often that fight can escalate beyond where it should be. When a person is focused on making shalom, even when a fight is necessary, it will serve to hold that fight in check. Yes, Mrs. Starkman. Yeah.
Also, I want to add that shalom is one of Hashem's names.
Yeah.
So the reason Hashem wants, he created the world of Shalom. The name of Shalom is Shalom, Hashem's name. It sanctifies his name. He wants Shalom.
And
unifies people.
Very good. Yes, he definitely wants Shalom, and that is one of his names. That is why one is not allowed to say the word Shalom when one is in the restroom. One is not supposed to say the name Shalom. Even if a person's name is Shalom, you're not supposed to use that name in the bathroom. That is because that is one of Hashem's names. Even though it's not sanctified to the point that you're not allowed to write it or erase it, you can write it and erase it. It's not like Yud Kei Vav Kei or something like that. Still, we don't say it in the bathroom for that reason. We still have to explain over here, even if it is Hashem's name, why we start with Shalom when you know it's going to fail. So we're explaining because it helps set us up on the right direction, that this, even though we have to have conflict, but we're aiming for shalom. Good. Okay. So, that is the war with Sichon. Well, this war hasn't happened yet, but Sichon refuses to let the Jews enter. So, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 31, we have the war with Sichon. Again, this is mentioned first in Parshas Chukas, and here we are recounting it. Vayomer Hashem Eli, Hashem said to me, Re'ei hachilosi teis lefanacha es Sichon ve'es artzo. Behold, or see, I have begun to put before you Sichon and his land. Hachel rosh l'resh es es artzo. Begin to conquer his land. Vayetzei Sichon likrasenu. Sichon came out to greet us, to fight us. Hu v'chol amo l'milchama. He and his entire nation for war. Yatza to Yatza. To Yatz, I believe. I just want to see how the word, yeah, to Yahatz. The name of it is Yahatz. The hey at the end means two. To Yahatz. Vayitineo Hashem Elokeinu lefanenu. Hashem put him before us. Vanach oso. We struck him down. Ves banav and his sons. Ves kolamo and all of his nation. Rashi points out that the word banav, which means his sons, is spelled, it's missing a yud. The way it's spelled without vowels would be Bino, his son, singular. He had sons, but he had a son who was as strong and powerful as he was. So therefore it says his son to emphasize that there was someone else in this battle that was as strong as Sichon, and we defeated them both. Vanil Konis Kolarav Boisahi, we conquered all of his cities at that time. Vanacharem es Kolir Mesim, and we destroyed all the men of the city. Vanashim Vahatov, and the women and the children. Loish Arnu Sarid, we did not leave anybody alive or anybody over, because this is the conquest of Eretz Yisrael already, and we're not allowed to leave anybody alive. Raka Behema Bazaznu Lanu, only the animals we took as spoils for ourselves. Ushlal Ha'arim Ashalachadnu, and the booty, the spoils of the cities that we captured. Me Aroer Asher Asfas Nachal Arnon, from Aroer, which is on the river of Nachal Arnon. Vihoir Asher Banachal, and the city that was in the riverbed, in the valley. Vana Gilad, until the Gilad. Lo Haisa Kirya, there was no settled area, Asher Sagva Mimenu, that was spared from us. As Hakol Nasan Hashem Elokeinu Lefanenu, Hashem gave everything into our hands. We conquered everything. Rak El Eretz Bnei Amon Lo Karavta, only to the land of Bnei Amon you did not get close. We didn't encroach on the land of Amon. Kol Yad Nachal Yabok V'Arei Ahar, everything that was next to the Nachal, the river Yabok, and the cities of the mountain. V'chol Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu, and all that Hashem commanded, we did not set foot in the land of Ammon. We stayed out of their land. We made sure we stayed only in Sichon's land. Vanefen Vanel Derech HaBashan. Then we turned and we went up the way of the Bashan. Now we're headed north. We're still in Aver HaYarden. We're still on the other side of the Jordan River, on the east bank, and now we're headed north. Vayetzei Og Melech HaBashan Likrosenu, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out to greet us, Hu V'chol Amo, he and all of his nation, Lamil Chama, for war, Edrei to Edrei. That's where the war happened. Vayomer Hashem Eli, Hashem said to me, Al Tira Oso, do not fear him. Because I've given him and all of his nation and all of his land into your hands. You will do to him as you did to Sichon, the king of the Amori, that is dwelling in Cheshbon. Here we review the famous Chazal. Why does Hashem have to tell Moshe Rabbeinu not to fear Og? He doesn't tell him don't fear Sichon. Moshe Rabbeinu had no reason to fear Sichon. Evidently there is a reason to fear Og. Why does he fear Og more than Sichon? So that is because Og had a zechus. He had a merit because he came and told Avraham about Lot. When Lot was taken captive by the four kings, it says, Vayavoha Polit, the one who escaped came, and that was Og, and he told Moshe Rabbeinu, Avraham Avinu, and because of that he had his zechus, he had a merit. And so Moshe Rabbeinu was afraid that maybe that zechus would protect Og, and Hashem says, don't be afraid, it will not protect him enough, you'll be able to defeat him. Pasuk Gimel verse 3. Yeah.
I just have a question. Why, if we're going to Midrash anyway, why that Midrash and not the one that Og survived the flood? Why wouldn't that be in his merit?
The question is, why not the fact that Og survived the flood? Why would that be a merit for him that he survived the flood?
You had to be good to survive.
Yeah, but you had to be good to survive, but then perhaps the merit was used up in surviving. The question is, what did he do that deserved for him to survive? So we don't know what he did to survive the flood. But here we have something that we know he did afterwards. But you're right, could be there's something else in his...
Wasn't there another midrash that he's the one that told Sarah about the Akedah?
Yeah, there is a medrash that he told Sarah about the Akedah. There
so
is
I'm just kind of curious why that medrash.
Not sure. There clearly is a, that's not a merit. This is a merit. We have to find a merit for him, otherwise why would Moshe Rabbeinu be afraid? So this is what we know about.
Yeah. Then his merit would have been used up. If you're going to look at all the midrashim.
Why
would you be afraid if you thought it was used up?
Yeah. We're not. Moshe Rabbeinu is not looking at all the midrashim. He knows something. Moshe Rabbeinu. We're trying to figure out what did Moshe Rabbeinu know.
Right.
So we know that there's a merit that he told Avraham. But I don't know why the other ones don't offset it. I don't know. Pasuk Gimel verse 3. Vayitein Hashem Elokeinu biyadeinu gamas Og melech haBashan ve'eskol amo. Hashem gave into our hands also Og the king of Bashan and all of his nation. Vanakeu, we struck him down ad bilti hi shelo sarid until nothing was left. Vaniel kodes kol harav ba'isahi, we captured all of his cities at that time. Lo esak kiryah shelo lakachnu me'itam, there was no city, no settled area that we did not take from him. Shishim ir, 60 cities kol chevel argov. The entire area of Argov, how do they translate that?
The region
of Argov. Mamleches Og Babashan, the kingdom of Og in the Bashan. Kolela, all of these Arim Bitsuros, they were fortified cities. Choma Givoa, big walls. De La Saim Uvariach, they had thick doors at the gates and they had bolts. Levad me'arei ha'perazi, not including, those 60 cities did not include the scattered cities, the cities that were not fortified, that had no walls. Harbe ma'od, many of them. There was a large kingdom. V'nachare ma'osam, we destroyed them, kasher asinu l'sichon melech cheshbon, as we did to Sichon, the king of Cheshbon. Achareim kol ir mesim hanashim v'hatof, we destroyed all of the city, the men, the women, and the children. V'chola be'ima, and all the animals, ushlal he'arim, and the booty of the cities, bazonu lanu, we took as spoils for ourselves. Chazal point out, Rashi cites it, that here it says bazonu, and which means we took as spoils, and earlier it says at the end of Pasuk, where is it? At the end of Pasuk
35.
Is that where it is? Thank you. At the end of Lamed 835, it says, Raka behema bazaznu lanu. Also, we took spoils. The word bozes is used over there, and here it says buzz. The difference is that bazaznu means we took everything like we took everything we could find. Bazonu is from the Lashon of Bizayon, of like it's unimportant, because once the Jews got the booty from Sichon, they were already quite wealthy from that conquest. So when they conquered Og, what had seemed to be important to them when they conquered Sichon was no longer important to them. They already had their fill. So when they took spoils from Og, they only took gold and silver, they didn't bother with anything else. So it was less exciting, the biza, the spoils from Og, than it was from Sichon. Pasuk Zion, Pasuk Ches, verse 8. We took at that time the land, Miyad, Shnei Malchei HaEmori, from the hands of the two kings of the Emori, Asheba Eivar HaYardin, that was on the other side of the Jordan River, Minach HaArnon, Ad Har Hermon, from the river Arnon to Mount Hermon. Now, the mountain of Hermon had different names. Tzidonim yikru'u l'Hermon Sirion. The Tzidonim would call Hermon Sirion. V'ha'emori yikru'u lo Sinir. And the Emori would call it Sinir. Sinir means snow. That's what the word Sinir means. But the Torah seems important to the Torah that we know that there were different names for this mountain. Hermon, Sirion, Sinir, and Rashi tells us there's a fourth name actually for this mountain, and that fourth name is Sion. So Rashi explains that the reason why the Torah tells us all the names is that we should know there were four different kings that were laying claim to this mountain, and each one gave it a different name to show you how badly they wanted the mountain, and it was given to us. Pasuk Yud, verse 10, Kol Arei HaMishor, all the cities of the plain, V'chol HaGilad, V'chol HaBashan, all of the Gilad and all of the Bashan, Ad Salcha Ve'edrei, until Salcha and Edrei, Arei Mamlechas Og BaBashan, the cities of the kingdom of Og in the Bashan. Now here we have, we're going to come back to this entire discussion soon, but here we have one of, I think, the most intriguing and mysterious psukim in the Torah. I mean, there's a lot of psukim in the Torah that have greater depth than you realize, than we realize. But this one just jumps out at you. Ki rak Og melech HaBashan nishar miyesa harifoyim, because only Og, the king of the Bashan, remained from the giants, from the Rephaim. Okay, that's all right. That's not so mysterious. Hinei arso eres barzel. His eres was an iron eres. Now they translate it as, what's that?
Bed.
Okay. It can also be translated as crib. It can be bed, it can be crib. It was an iron bed or crib. Halo hi berabas b'nei Amon. It is located in Rabas b'nei Amon. If you wanted to know where is that bed or that crib, it's in Rabas b'nei Amon. Meaning that it's a place, that's a city. Rabas was a place, a city in the country of Amon. Remember, the Jews were not allowed to attack Amon. And, by the way, Tesha Amos Arka, its length was 9 Amos. V'arba Amos Rachba, and its width was 4 Amos. Be'amas Ish, using the Amma of man. So, I think that the question stands on its own over here. I think we don't have to explain that. What on earth is that all about? Okay, so we have to explain that. Okay, I'm going to go just a couple of, I'm going to go two more psukim. Let's stop here for now. Okay. So what is this? The bed or the crib, 9 amos by 4 amos using the measurement of a man.
Well, it says that man.
Well, it doesn't say that.
Oh.
It just says man. But that is the way Chazal understand it. Using the Amma of Og himself. Okay. So first of all, what's that?
It wouldn't have fit otherwise.
Okay. So,
showing us how big it really is.
All right. First of all, how big is an Amma? So an Amma measures, from the elbow to the tips of the fingers. That would be an Amma. Now normally there has to be some sort of a standard Amma. Otherwise, how do you measure anything? Can't be just use your own Amma, because then
we're all different.
Right. So there is a machlokes today. How big is an Amma? It's relevant today for a number of different halachos. Dalid Amos, four Amos, which is relevant for Shabbos, and it's relevant for davening. There's many things that it's relevant for. How much is four Amos? There's different opinions. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that an Amma is 21 1/4 inches. 21 1/4 inches. If you multiply it out, Dalid Amos, four Amos, is just about 7 feet. 7 feet is four Amos. And that's what Rav Moshe Feinstein writes for Dalit Amos. How much is 9 Amos? Because this is 9 by 4. 9 Amos is 16 feet. So if we use Rav Moshe Feinstein's measurement for an Amma, then we would have that this bed or this crib is 16 feet by 4 feet. By 7 feet, right? 4 Amos, thank you. 16 feet by 7 feet. Now, a standard mattress, a standard twin-size mattress which fits one person, is 6 feet long. You can get an extra long one if you're taller than that, but a typical one is 6 feet long. And I don't know exactly the width, but I imagine it's something like 2 feet, approximately.
4
feet? No,
twin.
6 feet long.
Twin.
Twin.
Like
a twin?
A twin like this, yeah.
This is not 4 feet. I don't think.
It's more than two feet.
Yeah. Maybe 3 feet. Okay. Let's.
Two feet is only this.
Yeah. It's
so let's say 3 feet. Call 3 feet.
Okay, 3 feet.
I don't think the width of a twin size mattress is 2/3 of its length. I don't think it's 4 feet. So I think it's 6 feet by about 3 feet. So that's a single bed. Now, if you get a queen size or a king size mattress, so it's wider. They're not typically longer. They're still 6 feet, maybe 7 feet. They're not typically that much longer. So the, maybe 6 feet by 6 feet, if it's square. But to fit one person, 6 feet by 3 feet is certainly adequate. So, here we have 16 feet by 7 feet. Now we're talking for one person. Now we're more than doubling the length and width. Now the proportion seems to be in order, meaning the proportion of the width to the length seems to be appropriate, because that's approximately what we have. It's approximately the length is about double the width. And 6 feet by 3 feet. And here is 16 feet by 7 feet. Okay, it's a little bit more, but it's not that makes sense. But it is very large. It's a really, really big, bed. Does it say you have the measurement over there? No?
Yeah, 38 inches by 75 inches is a twin mattress.
Okay, so 75 inches is
6 feet.
A little bit more than 6 feet. 6 feet, three inches. And 35, what did you say, how many?
38 inches.
How much?
38.
38 inches, three feet and 2 inches. Yeah. So it's about double, it's approximately double the length to the width. And here, you're talking about a really large bed, a gigantic bed. What's that?
He's a giant.
Okay, wait, so more than that, it says the amma that you're going to use to measure it is not the typical amma, but rather his amma. So we don't know what his amma is. We don't know, right? Because that means there's no way to figure it out. Because if you tell me you should measure it by his measurements, and this is to tell you his measurements, we don't know his measurements. So the Torah is not telling you exactly how big Og was. Because we can't, it's circular reasoning. It's telling you how big Og was by using the measurements of Og. But we don't know how big Og was. This is how we're supposed to figure it out. This is supposed to be the way that we're teaching us how big Og was.
So, why do we need to know?
Okay, why do we need to know? Okay, so that's the thing is that we don't know. This is not a definitive answer for how big Og was. We can say with certainty that a bed was needed that was 16 feet by 7 feet. which is a bed that measured by today's standards would be more than double the size of a single bed for today's twin size mattress, a typical sized bed today. So it's more than double the size in both dimensions, not just width, but also length. It's not width in order to have two people in the same bed, it's also length, because we're talking about a bigger person. He needed a bigger bed. It's not teaching us exactly how big. He's minimally twice the size of a regular person. He may be bigger than that, because we're going to use his amma to measure.
He's taller.
What's that?
It seems that he's much taller. His length is much taller than his
arms. So here's the thing, that a regular human being, right? We are a regular human being, so we would say that a typical bed, if we're going to use the measurements that we have over here, is going to be, we'll call it 4 amos, it's really a little less than 4 amos long, by about 2 amos wide.
Right.
And that's our amos. He's going to be 9 amos by 4 amos with his amma. So it's proportionally out of whack. Not the way we look, his arms are going to be smaller than his height and his width. Now, we don't know if that looks funny. You really need to speak to someone who is good at, someone who's a good, like an artist or whatever it is, because when you draw things proportionally bigger, they don't look the same. I once read about this. If you take a pencil and you want to make like a pencil that would be the size of a human being, you would change its dimensions. It would look funny. It wouldn't look like a pencil. The way we look at things, if you took the exact dimensions of a pencil and you made it as wide as a human being and then you proportionally made it longer, it wouldn't look normal to us. They just, our eyes don't work that way. You make it shorter in relative to its thickness. And it not the same way as when you have a thinner, smaller pencil. It's just the way things look differently to us. So I'm not sure if he looked funny, or if when you expand the length and the width to that level, you need to shorten the arms in order for it to look normal, quote unquote. Whatever it is, he didn't follow anything about the regular proportions of a human being. He was much taller, much wider. And, like you said, the arms are not going to be the same proportion to the body. There's a machlokes whether this was his bed or this was his crib. Mm-hmm. If it was his crib, well, then already the length of arm to body might already be within more typical measurements. I'm not sure with a baby if the arm length compared to the body length is the same as it is to an adult. I'm not sure. I don't know. But whatever it is, if it was the measurement of a crib, then that was when he was a little baby. When he got older, imagine the size of whatever bed he used. It had to be an iron bed. The Ramban writes, because a wooden bed, which was the typical material for a bed, was not strong enough to hold him. The Ramban says it was for a baby, since a baby thrashes around, and therefore he would have broken the wooden crib. And therefore it had to be made of iron. Whereas an adult is more, it doesn't treat furniture the same way that a baby does. So there would be, when he was older, it could be made out of wood. But as a baby, they had to construct an iron crib for him to prevent him from breaking that crib. That's how the Ramban understands it. Either way, whether it's a crib or a bed, either way, we're talking about a very, very, very large person. Where was this bed or this crib? Amon. It was in Amon. What is it doing in Amon? Why would it be in Amon? So, let us hold the place here on page 954. Let's turn back to what we read last week about the conquest of Amon. On page 950... On page 950, so the pasuk says, that you're now going to, starting with Yud Zayin 17, you're now crossing the border and you are getting close to where Ammon lives. You may not have any war with them, so stay away from them. And there it says, in Pasuk Chaf, verse 20, Eretz Rephaim Techashev Afhi, the land of Ammon would also be considered the land of Rephaim, of giants. Rephaim Yashvu Valefanim, there had been giants living there. V'ha'amonim yikru lohem zamzumim. The Ammonim referred to them as zamzumim. Am gadol v'rav v'ram ka'anakim. They were a nation that was many and large and powerful like giants. V'yashmidem Hashem ipnehem. Hashem destroyed them from before the Ammonim. V'yirashum. They conquered them by yeshvu tachtam, and they dwelled in their place. The countries of Moab and Ammon. Moab was further south and Ammon was further north. And Sichon and Og as well. Sichon was further south, Og was further north. The land of Ammon used to be part of Og's land. It was the land of Rephaim, of the giants. And Hashem destroyed the giants from before Ammon. The Bnei Ammon were able to destroy them. That's what we learned last week. Also, the Bnei Moav were able to destroy the giants that came before them. We pointed out that all of this is part of the Musar, part of the criticism to the Jewish people. Even Edom, Moav, and Ammon, who you're not allowed to attack, Hashem says, they were able to come in and defeat nations that were much bigger, much stronger than they were. They shouldn't have been able to do that. But I decreed that they would have those lands because those are the lands that were supposed to go to Avraham's descendants. And as we pointed out, Lot got two of those lands and Esav got one of those lands. And I wiped them out from before them. So too, you had no reason to send spies. You had no reason to fear. Just as I gave the land to whoever I wanted to with Moab and Ammon and Edom, so too your land I'm giving to you. There is no reason to be having this issue of spies and fearing the wars, etc. So it's part of the Musar, it's part of the criticism. The giants lived in the land of Ammon, and of Moab actually, and Hashem destroyed them from before them. The Og, his bed or his crib, was in Rabbas, was in the great city of Ammon. Of Ammon. It was in the great city of Ammon. Why? Because they kept it as a remembrance of what they had defeated. Look at this bed, or look at this crib. This was part of the nation that was living here, and we beat them up. We took over. Trust me, they weren't giving thanks to Hashem. This was their sign of strength. Look how we wiped them out. And that's why the Pasuk is telling us over here that the Bnei Ammon kept that bed to remember where they had come from and what had happened, that they had been able to destroy the giants that were living there. And Og is one of those giants. When it says that he was the one who got away, he was Miyeser HaRifayim, he was from the remainder of the giants. So we know that, as was already pointed out, that back in Parshas Lech Lecha, he's called HaPalit. Og is called the Palit. Palit means that he was the escapee. He got away. So there in Parshas Lech Lecha, when it says he was the one who escaped, there are two explanations. One is he escaped the Mabul. He survived the great flood. The other is he survived the four kings, because the four kings also attacked and destroyed the giants in their day. And Og got away. Og had a penchant for escaping. He escaped the Mabul. He escaped the four kings. He escaped Ammon and Moab here as well. He was able to escape. He survived. They kept his bed or his crib as a testament to what they had been able to do. But Og got away. Og did not get away from Moshe Rabbeinu. But Og is able to escape everybody, but not Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah.
So your question before about Moshe afraid of Og, why wouldn't he be afraid? Why don't we look at it that way?
Okay, because why wouldn't he be afraid?
He escaped the flood.
Yes.
I mean, Hashem apparently
was saving him.
Right.
Right. So why wouldn't he? He should be afraid. He sees Og's the one who always escapes.
Right.
Right. Right. Very good. Then what Chazal is saying is, why was he afraid of Og and not of Sichon? Mm-hmm. You're pointing out Og seems to have a history of survival, where Sichon doesn't have that history.
Right.
Right.
But did Sichon survive from the Ammon Wars too?
So we don't know. Did Sichon survive the Ammon Wars? He may have. It doesn't say that he did. With Og, he's called the survivor. So I don't know. It's a good question.
Were there other lands that had giants besides Ammon?
So were there other lands that had giants? I don't know. It doesn't seem that way. I don't know. It seems that this is, because that's what we have over here. I read it to you last time. We haven't actually gotten to it tonight yet. But the Torah is going to end off by saying, this is the land of the Rephaim, this is the land of the giants that I'm giving to Avraham. When I said I was going to give you the land of the giants, I did not mean those other lands. I meant this land over here, the where Sichon and Og currently reside. So it's a good question. I don't know. And you're right that if he has a penchant for escaping, then perhaps that would be the reason to fear him. Chazal seemed to feel that Moshe Rabbeinu had to have a more concrete reason for being afraid. Hashem says, you know, conquer. So what's he afraid? Yeah, he was huge. Sichon was also very, very powerful, evidently. So I don't know if he was as big as Og, but he was very, very powerful as well.
Why would the Torah give us dimensions of the bed he was sleeping in now?
Yeah, why not give us dimensions of the bed? I think because the question is, why didn't the Torah give us the dimensions of the bed he was sleeping in now? So if you learn that it means his crib, then that's why. What we're interested in is, look, that was for a baby, imagine now. If not, I think because of what we're trying to bring out is that the Ammon people kept the bed. That's what we're trying to bring out over here. The thing is, at the end of the day, we don't know how big he was. It doesn't say. Because, as I said, you can't tell me a measurement by telling me measure with his measurements. That's not going to tell you anything. It's good. So you haven't learned anything from that. But we do see he was gigantic. The Gemara in Maseches Brachos gives incredible proportions to Og. It's not clear whether that is an exaggeration or not. Sometimes the Gemara does exaggerate these things, and it's unclear when the Gemara exaggerates, it's in order to teach us a lesson. It's deliberate. We don't know. What the Gemara says is that Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amos tall, and he had a sword that was 10 amos long, and he jumped 10 amos, and he hit Og in the ankle. 30 amos off the ground. So that would seem to be a guzma, it seems to be an exaggeration, but I don't know. He was definitely a very, 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 very large person. That is clear. And he's defeated. Now, this is the first conquest of Eretz Yisrael, meaning that had they let us go through peacefully, I don't know what would have happened, because even though Moshe Rabbeinu knew they were not going to let us through peacefully, but had they let us go through peacefully, then I guess there would not have been a war. But this is the first conquest of Eretz Yisrael, even though it's not Eretz Yisrael proper, it's Eber HaYarden, it's the east bank of the Jordan River, but it was the first of the conquests of the seven nations that were not allowed to leave anybody alive. Lo sechayek, kol neshama, don't leave anybody alive. We had to kill them all, and that is men, women, and children. It does sound brutal, and it is the mitzvah of Hashem, that Hashem told us that when you go and you conquer Eretz Yisrael, you may not leave any survivors. They had three choices. Their choices, when Yehoshua goes into the land, he's going to give them three choices. Their choices are death, run away, or convert. Those are your three choices. They may not stay in the land and remain as they are. They may either leave, they may convert, or they will be killed. And that was the choices he gave them. The Girgashi, that nation, ran away. They left. They didn't stay. So they took that option. And the other ones chose to fight and they were killed. There were those, we didn't do the mitzvah 100% the way we were supposed to, and that's a whole story in Sefer Yehoshua. By today's standards, it seems like, how could you do that? You can talk about genocide, etc. But of course, we are never apologetic for what the Torah says. It is the mitzvah of Hashem, and that's what we were supposed to do. It doesn't have, that particular mitzvah does not have relevance to us today, because that was a mitzvah for them at that time. There's no mitzvah today to do that. We still have a mitzvah with Amalek, but we don't have a mitzvah with the nations of Eretz Yisrael. That was a mitzvah for the original conquest of Eretz Yisrael. Why is it that it has to be that complete? It's a good question. We're actually going to get to that mitzvah later in Sefer Devarim. The mitzvah actually is written later on, and when we get to their mitzvah, Hashem will discuss it. Yes?
Here in the Pasuk.
Yeah.
It says in the art scroll,
yeah,
that the Canaanites were not given that choice. They would have surrendered, but Hashem made them decide to fight to the death.
Right. Okay, thank you. It says in the notice that Hashem did not... He made them fight. Right, because he hardened their heart.
You're right.
Yeah.
We're natati b'yadecha.
Yeah, right. So here... Right, so Hashem didn't want them to surrender. That's right.
Or flee.
Right. So in this case, they Hashem hardened Sichon's heart so that he would fight, and Og as well. Right. He wanted there to be a conquest this time, not them to get away. But when Yehoshua goes in, he's going to give them that choice. And the Girgashi are the ones that run away. The other ones choose to fight. Right.
Do we have any guesses to how big Goliath was?
Do we have any guesses to how big Goliath was? It gives some proportions over there in Sefer Shmuel. It's not this size.
Okay.
It's not this size. It's certainly not the size of the Gemara and Brachos. That for sure not that. But he was a very large man. It does not seem that he was of giant proportions like this, but he was very, very big. And the Gemara tells us that Arpah, who was the mother of Goliath, that she had four sons who were all very, very large. The truth is, since we don't really know how big Og was, maybe he was the same size. But what I'm saying is, we're not talking about hundreds of amos tall. We're not talking about, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk. We're talking about a very, very, very large person, much bigger than a regular person, therefore much more powerful.
I'm just kind of curious, because we have these two who die now, and we don't have any more talks of giants until
right.
we get to go.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's a big span
right,
of years.
Right. We don't have giants until there. It seems that Arpa had a zechus that she would have giants. They didn't come from giants. They came from Arpa. That's what it seems. Right. Okay. So that now brings us to Moshe Rabbeinu giving out the land that they've just conquered. And we know that it's going to go to Reuven and to Gad and to half the tribe of Menashe. The truth is, I just don't want to rush these psukim. So I think we're going to stop here. Even though we're close to the end of the parasha, I assume next week we'll finish this and also start Parshas Va'eschanan. But the giving out of the land is now going to be discussed, which is the end of Parshas Devarim. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.